Welcome to the class here. I guess we're entitling it, Does God Exist? Does He Exist? And this is a type of prologue for every other doctrine in the Bible, and really it's a prologue to everything in all of life. We have to get this prologue, this preface down pat, the introduction down pat, in order for everything else to make sense. What is the sense of talking or preaching anything out of the Bible if first a person does not even really believe in the existence of God? Why, if a person does believe God exists but doesn't believe the Bible's true, well, you're going to have to back up and understand the reliability of the Bible. And hopefully we'll be covering some of these topics here, the two of the most basic things in all of life, and that is, does God exist? Hopefully we'll answer that question. And if He does exist, has He communicated Himself in any way to us? Has He spoken to us? So, I believe yes, there is a God, and He does exist, and He has given us various testimonies to His existence. Now, I say testimonies, okay? By way of introduction, some of you may perhaps have, listening by way of CD, you may perhaps have our handout notes there, and you'll notice up there at the top that we're calling these testimonies. We aren't calling these proofs to the existence of God, nor are we calling them arguments to the existence of God, because none of these necessarily 100% actually prove God's existence. If that would be the case, then there would absolutely be no unbelievers today, right? You understand it. So we call them testimonies to the existence of God. And also, by way of introduction, we need to look at the nature of the evidence that we are going to be discussing today. Now, I'm going to need you to sit up straight. You cannot be distracted by what someone else is wearing or other things around you. I'm going to need you to sit up straight and to pay attention. We're going to be getting deep and philosophical in some certain things. I'll try to put the cookies on the lower shelf. But on some of this, we need to make sure that it hits us right in the head. Had a professor one time in college who was oftentimes accused of speaking over the heads of individuals. And he said to the class, why don't you just sit up straight so that it actually hits you right in the head instead of slouching? And I know, stupid little joke there, or anecdote. And speaking of the existence of God, I'm sure that all of you have heard about the agnostic who was dyslexic, who was forevermore questioning the existence of dog. Another stupid joke, right? But back to the nature of existence, of the evidence that we are looking at. In other words, I want to deal with a crackers in the pantry fallacy. I call it the crackers in the pantry fallacy, and by way of illustration, to introduce this nature of evidence fallacy, I'll use the illustration of, if I were to ask you, would you go check and see downstairs in the basement of the church and look in the pantry and see if there's any crackers there? Now, how would you go about answering that question and finding out if there is actual evidence of crackers in the pantry? Well, you would actually go downstairs, go into the kitchen, put your hand on the cupboard door, open it up, and look in there, touch the box of crackers, and you would actually see, well, yes, there are crackers in this pantry. And you would touch the box, right? You wouldn't just imagine that here in this church that we would actually put a box up there without crackers in it, right? So you would look inside the box and find out if there's crackers in the pantry. Now, we need to understand that we cannot find evidence for everything in this life in the same way. Since God is a spirit, we must not insist on the same type of proof that we demand for the existence of material things. We can't answer the question of God in the same way that we answer any other factual question. Nor can we explain a number of other ways by this crackers in the pantry fallacy. We would never be able to determine, if we just go look in the pantry or just go look and find what, we would never be able to determine the existence of God, let alone barometric pressure or quasars or gravitational attraction. I'm not talking about gravitational pull, I'm talking about gravitational attraction or elasticity. We wouldn't be able to determine radioactivity, natural laws, names even, grammar of various languages, numbers and what numbers actually mean in and of themselves. Those of you who are mathematicians, you would actually know I'm speaking the truth there. You wouldn't be able to determine exactly what the place is that we are at, the church or the home that you are listening to. Past events. Say, now, wait a minute. I can determine past events. I read them in a history book. Oh, is that so? You weren't actually there, though. Yes, they tell us that George Washington was the first president of the United States. But look, friends, you can find anything you want printed in this information age today, right? You can find anything you want on the internet. So how can you really be sure of past events taking place? Categories of various things in life, future contingencies. Well, if this happens this way, perhaps it'll happen a different way next time. Future contingencies, laws of thought, law, political obligations, individual identity over time, causation. What causes certain things? You'd never be able to determine what causes a certain something. Memories. How in the world can you rely on a memory or even prove what a memory is? How can you even prove the existence of a dream? It could be a figment of your imagination. Or how can you even determine love or beauty? In other words, friends, all of these things I've just mentioned, barometric pressure, quasars, gravitational attraction, elasticity, radioactivity, natural laws, names, grammar, numbers, the place itself, your church, your home, past events, categories, future contingencies, laws of thought, political obligations, individual identity over time, causation, memories, dreams, even love or beauty, let alone the existence of God, you cannot prove them all by, let's go to the pantry and see if it's actually there. It's a crackers in the pantry fallacy. You cannot prove all things the exact same way, right? Right. And we also need to understand, by way of introduction, the presuppositional conflict of worldviews. In other words, this is another fallacy that is out there in which some people say, I am neutral. I am completely neutral to the topic at hand. Therefore, I can, since I am a completely good, neutral individual, I can actually determine the existence or the non-existence of God. That is a pretended fallacy that we call the pretended neutrality fallacy. Everyone has a presupposition. Everyone has a pre-commitment. Everyone has a presupposition to this topic as well as to most other topics. How about this topic? Let me give you a statement, and I want you to tell me what is wrong with this statement. Now, if you've been sitting up and paying attention, you'll be able to tell me here in just a little bit what's wrong with this statement. If not, then perhaps you need to start back over and make sure that you're sitting up and paying attention so that you can think through with me. Here's the statement. Tell me what's wrong with this. The use of reason is the only way to determine if something is factual. Unquote. How can you prove a statement like that? How can you prove that statement? The use of reason is the only way to determine if something is factual or not. How do you prove that statement? Because obviously there is a pre-commitment to reason and to logic built right into it. And if you say, well, no, I don't believe that reason or logic is the only way to prove if anything is factual, well, obviously, you're going out of the bounds of reason and logic. In other words, you're in a circular reasoning there. So, friends, we don't want to be using circular reasoning, but here's the problem. The problem concerning the existence of God is this, is that unbelievers or atheists or agnostics say to us as Christians, well, we are completely neutral on this subject, and we have to find God just like we find every other thing, the crackers in the pantry fallacy, and also we are completely neutral to this subject. Hogwash! Everyone has a pre-commitment and a presupposition to this. Unbelievers, agnostics, and atheists often accuse Christians of using circular reasoning when they use the exact same kind of reasoning with their logic. They say, well, the use of reason is the only way to determine if something is factual. How do you know that's true? How do you know that's absolutely true or not? Can you give something that proves that statement? Not necessarily. So, and also, still by way of introduction, I want us to talk about these testimonies that we're going to give. We're going to be talking about does God exist and the testimonies here in just a bit, but we have to understand the logic of this introduction. We've talked about, we call them testimonies, not arguments or proofs. We've talked about the nature of evidence, the crackers in the pantry fallacy. We've talked about the presuppositional conflict of worldviews. There's a worldview of an atheist, agnostic, unbeliever, and there's the worldview of the Christian, and they both presuppose and have a pre-commitment even before they discuss this topic. But we're also, fourthly, going to look at the characteristics of general revelation. The testimonies that I'm going to be giving to you are called general revelation. What do we mean by general revelation? God reveals himself. That's revelation. And so in these testimonies, we're going to be talking about God revealing himself in these testimonies, but they're general. It's not specific. They're general in its geography. It reaches all people, encompassing the entire globe. As a matter of fact, it says in Psalm 19:2 that the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day in the day utter speech, and night to night they are telling forth knowledge. There's no speech and there's no language where their voice is not heard. General revelation in God's creation, everyone hears it and sees it. Not just in the United States of America or in Britain or in Canada or in Mexico, in North America or South America, it's everywhere. As a matter of fact, Jesus even said in Matthew 5:45 that God makes his rain to shine, his rain to fall on the just and the unjust, and his sun to shine on the just and the unjust. Everyone, everywhere experiences it. In Acts chapter 14, verse 17. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself. God did not leave himself without a witness. In that he did good. He gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. In other words, this general revelation that we're going to be talking about is general in geography. It scopes the entire globe, but it's also general in its methodology. It employs universal means like creation, Psalm 19, the heat of the sun. And also, it employs human conscience. In Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 16 through 16, it says this, "For when Gentiles who do not have the law, the Jewish Old Testament law, by nature do the things that are in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness in between themselves, their thoughts accusing or else excusing them, in the day when God will judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ, according to my gospel." In other words, general revelation is general geographically, but it's general methodologically. It is speaking about creation and it speaks about conscience. So, now, as long as we understand those things there, we're calling these testimonies, as long as we understand the crackers in the pantry fallacy, you don't go out to prove the fact of something in the exact same way in every instance. And since we also need to understand the presuppositional conflict of worldviews, the pretended neutrality fallacy, and also the characteristics of general revelation, let's talk about now the actual testimonies to the existence of God. The first one that I'm going to give, which is ultimately, this is ultimately the one for you and the one for everyone. It is the best one. I don't have the time to philosophically or even theologically explain this, but this is the best one. It is called the faith testimony. And that is, I accept God's existence by faith. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, it says, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it, by faith, the elders," the people who lived in the Old Testament, "obtained a good report." And then in verse 6, "Without faith, it is impossible to please God. For he who comes to God must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. In other words, dear friend, you may be listening to this and you may be a complete skeptic concerning the existence of God. You may label yourself a Christian who has fallen away. You may label yourself an agnostic. You may label yourself an atheist. Or you, as a Christian, may be trying to deal with someone who calls themselves an atheist or calls themselves an agnostic or calls themselves a Christian who has fallen away or an unbeliever. What is the best thing for them? And that is, dear friend, this. There is no amount of testimony that is going to suffice them. We'll talk about this in a little bit later and explore it out, but there's no amount of testimony that will ultimately, completely convince them. We have to accept it. And a person who has a real relationship with God has the relationship by faith. And faith is just not wishful thinking, friends. It's a live, vibrant thing. It's a real relationship, which we'll be talking about later. That is the faith testimony. And you say, boy, Aaron, I sure hope your testimonies get a whole lot better. Again, I said I don't have the time to philosophically or theologically get into how faith is ultimately the best one. And yes, perhaps you would say, that is circular reasoning, Aaron. I accept God. God exists because I accept him by faith. There's a lot of fallacies with that. Yes. Well, let's go on and look at some others. The scriptural testimony. And the statement of this is the Bible assumes and states God's existence. Since the Bible assumes and states God's existence, therefore God exists. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, it says that in the beginning, God created. It does not explain the existence of God. It doesn't state. It assumes that God does exist. In Psalm 94, verse 9, and in Isaiah chapter 40, one of the greatest chapters in the Old Testament concerning the greatness and the exaltation of our God, it doesn't even seek to try to explain him, but tries to communicate him on a level that we understand. The scriptures do not seek to prove the existence of God because he actually does exist. Now, some of you may be listening to me right now here in the class by way of CD, and you may be, or by way of the internet, and you may be thinking, boy, I sure hope that these testimonies get better, because there is nothing scientific, nothing cogent that has really grabbed my mind in proving to me that God exists. Yeah, God exists because I believe he exists by faith. God exists because the Bible says that he exists. Well, there is this statement, which to me, this transcendental testimony, the faith testimony, this testimony, and the last one, which we'll be mentioning, I believe, are the most cogent. The transcendental testimony to the existence of God. And here's the statement. Transcendentals exist. And God is a transcendental. Therefore, God exists. You say, some of you may be thinking, well, what in the world is a transcendental? Well, first let me go on in stating the statement, that is, that without God, it is impossible to prove anything whatsoever. Okay? My question, dear friend, is this. In an atheistic, materialistic, naturalistic world and worldview, how do you account for or justify transcendentals? Say, now, what's a transcendental? Let's talk about what a transcendental is. A transcendental is an absolute. It is something that actually does exist. It's an absolute. It may not be something that you can actually tangibly put your fingers on like a cracker's in the pantry, but it's an absolute. And it is an abstract, such as love, beauty. You say, well, I can put my fingers on some things that I love or beauty, but how do you actually describe in the description of love and beauty? That is something that is abstract, correct? Because your definition of love and beauty would not be an Aboriginal Australian's definition of love and beauty, correct? But both have ideas of love and beauty in their mind. So how do you account for a transcendental? A transcendental is an absolute, it's abstract, and it's an entity that is out there. It's immaterial. You cannot tangibly touch it. It's immaterial, and it's an invariant. It doesn't vary from time to time. It's a constant. It is unconventional. It's not just built upon my convenience. It's unconventional and it's unsociological. In other words, it crosses racial boundaries and national boundaries. It's unsociological. It's in every sociological system. And it's universal. It's found everywhere. So, do you understand what a transcendental is? Do I need to explain that again? I'll give some illustrations of it here in just a bit, but let's go over the definition of a transcendental again. A transcendental is an absolute, abstract entity that is immaterial, invariant, unconventional, unsociological, and universal. Examples are three: laws of logic, laws of morality, and laws of nature. Now let's give lots of illustrations in those three. Laws of logic. Names of people. A name is not necessarily something that you can reach right out there and touch. It's an abstract. What a person is called is a name. Grammar in any language. Education. How can you really account for exactly what an education is? You say, well, education, I have an education. I have a diploma. I graduated from such and such a university. No, friends, I'm not talking about the diploma you have. I'm talking about the stuff that is actually communicated to your brain. Laws of logic concerning past events, concerning categories, how we categorize life or categorize things, future contingencies, your thoughts, your memories of certain things, dreams, political obligations. All of those are transcendentals. They're absolute abstract entities that are immaterial, invariant, unconventional, unsociological, and universal. They're found in every society. Right? They are. How about laws of morality? Love. Beauty. Morals. By the way, and we'll hit this later on, how is it that morals are everywhere? No matter what society you go to, it is wrong to take another man's wife. How is that so? We're different skin color. We're different in cultures. Some still hold to headhunting, but how is it that no matter what culture you go to, it is still wrong to take another man's wife, and it is wrong to kill a friend? It's wrong to kill a friend. How did that get there? Laws of morality such as murder and torture. Adolf Hitler, at the end of World War II, it was estimated, had murdered over 6 million Jews. By 1938, the world Jewish population was 11 million, it was estimated. Hitler had obliterated 6 of the 11 million. And that doesn't include Poles and Gypsies, as well as the mentally deranged that he called mentally deranged, that were annihilated as well. Now, I would say that every last one of us here would go and say that Adolf Hitler and Hitler's Third Reich Germany was completely wrong. My question to you is this: how can you say that he's wrong? How can you say that? What is your basis for saying that Adolf Hitler's Germany is wrong? You say, well, it's wrong to obliterate other people. And I'm saying to you, yeah, but where do you get your sense of right and wrong? Where do you get that sense? Don't tell me, you better not tell me, that your sense of morality comes from the world group of people that is surrounding you, and that laws of morality is a general consensus of good of the people around you. Because then, dear friend, if you say that, then you cannot say that Hitler's Germany is wrong, because the entire Third Reich looked at Jews, the majority of them, yes, there were a few who were in opposition, but the majority of them looked at Jews, Poles, gypsies, and retarded people as non-human beings. Therefore, by your definition of morality, boy, I get my morals from whatever is the best good for the people around me. I get my morals from the general consensus of good of the people around me. By your definition, dear friend, you are saying that Hitler's Third Reich was right in doing what they did. They were just wrong in letting it out, and perhaps wrong in attacking other countries when they crossed the line into Czechoslovakia. Am I making sense? How can you say that Hitler's Germany is bad? Or how about the Marquis de Sade? The Marquis de Sade enjoyed torturing women. Now, who are you to say that the Marquis de Sade is wrong for torturing women? It was within his own palace. He and his lackeys agreed to it. It met their own pleasures. Therefore, that was their consensus of good. Who are you to tell him? And where do you come up with your sense of morality? What I'm telling you, dear Christian friend, is this. Or, dear friend, perhaps you're an atheist or an agnostic, that if you have and say that the Marquis de Sade was wrong and that Hitler's Germany was wrong in the concerning your laws of morals, you are borrowing a Christian worldview. You are not borrowing an atheistic, agnostic worldview. You're borrowing my personal worldview. And so I go back to the question, in an atheistic, materialistic, naturalistic worldview, how do you account for or justify transcendentals? How do you justify laws of logic? How do you justify laws of morality? And thirdly, that we're going to illustrate now, how do you justify laws of nature or science? Barometric pressure, quasars, gravitational attraction, elasticity, radioactivity, numbers, and even time itself. Now, here's the point. In all of these areas, atheists, agnostics, use all of these that I've just described to you. But in so doing, they borrow a Christian worldview. Here's the point. If you acknowledge that there are laws of logic, that's a transcendental. You can't go out and find it in the pantry like you do a box of crackers. If you believe that there are laws of morality that are out there, it's a transcendental. You can't go find it in the pantry like you do a box of crackers. And if you believe that there are laws of science and nature, that's a transcendental. You can't go out there and find it like you do a box of crackers in the pantry. If you believe and use laws of logic, laws of science, laws of morality, which are transcendentals, why can't you believe that God exists? Because God himself is a transcendental, an absolute abstract entity that is immaterial, invariant, unconventional, unsociological, and universal. So, to me, the transcendental testimony, for the sake of time, we have to move on. But I would encourage you to investigate more into this. I've tried to make things as crystal clear concerning the transcendental testimony of the existence of God. Perhaps some of you may be thinking, boy, I don't know if I'm grasping this. Please feel free to call, see me, email me. We'd be glad to try to explain or put some resources into your hand to make even more clear to you the transcendental testimony to the existence of God, which I believe is one of the most cogent testimonies to God's existence. There is the cosmological testimony. Cosmological, if we could look at it, the cause. In other words, as I look out here at the creation, there is a cause. Everything that has begun must have an adequate cause. The universe was begun, therefore the universe must have an adequate cause for its production. In Psalm 19, verses 1 through 6, we've made reference to Psalm 19 and quoted some of it. God created all that we see. Creation itself has been caused and is speaking to us of its cause. In Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32, it speaks of creation speaking to us as well. And in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 4. So, If something now exists, friends, one of two things must be true. If something now exists, something must be eternal, unless something came from nothing. Isn't that right? If something exists right now, something must be eternal unless something comes from nothing. Either the world came from nothing or the world came from something eternal. You say, well, it came from the Big Bang. Okay, what caused the Big Bang? Gases getting together. Now, no jokes about gas, all right? I'm refraining, you refrain from gas as well. But where did the gases come from? Okay, and then whatever caused the gases, well, where did that come from? Friends, we could keep going back further and further and further, but I'm going to keep asking you, matter is not eternal. Eternal chance? Is it eternal matter or eternal chance, or is it eternal God? There must be something eternal. Moving on now to the teleological testimony, the purpose of an intelligent design that is out there. And it's stated this way: order and useful arrangement in a system imply intelligence and purpose in the organizing cause. In other words, if you see a nice little vase on my shelf in my home, you'll know that there was an intelligent person that put that together. I want you to know it would not be me that put the vase together if it's on our shelf. I have absolutely no artistic ability that way at all. But if you see the vase on a shelf, you would know that there was an intelligence that was greater than the clay that put that vase together, and there was a purpose in organizing it. Well, dear friend, our universe is characterized by order and a useful arrangement. Therefore, the universe has an intelligent and a free cause. Scripture concerning this in Psalm 8, verses 3 and 4, when I consider thy heavens, the works of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? Friends, when we consider the planets and the stars, how that they are very orderly and work in such minute detail, the earth's rotation around the sun, Psalm 19, which we've referred to often already, Psalm 19, verses 1 through 4. The cycle of the day, the earth revolving around the sun. If the earth were a few feet closer to the sun, we would burn up. If the earth were a few feet farther away from the sun, we would eventually freeze. But it just so happens that the only place in which there is life in our universe that we know of happens to be on a planet that just happens to be the right distance from the sun? You're telling me that's an accident? The accident that caused the Big Bang just so happens to have a sun with planets revolving around it in which we can calculate with precision their exact location? You're telling me that's an accident? And it just so happens that our sun is not one of the giant suns which burns greatly, nor is it one that is cooling off dramatically. That's an accident? Friends, there was a cause behind the entire thing. There is the evidence of a created order itself, testifying to the wisdom, power, plan, and glory of God. One should not miss the testimony, friends, of the solar system. How about the persuasion of the sea itself? The amazing intricacies of the human body. And I've told you about this before. The amazingness of the human body. Let's talk about one aspect of the human body that strikes me, and that is the nose. Why do you have two nostrils? If evolution were true, evolution is built on our completely getting better and better based on vestigial organs, organs which I just kind of grow because of the need, right? Because I need this, I'm going to grow this way and adapt this way. Well, if evolution is based on the growth of vestigial organs based on a body's need, why do you have two nostrils? You have one windpipe, your pharynx, which is in your throat, but why do you have two nostrils? If evolution is true, and a person who completely believes in evolution, I should have only one nostril. Yet I have two. Why is that? It's because there is an intelligent designer that is behind the entire plan. The intricacies of the human body. It just so happens, friends, it just so happens that when I get a cut, instantaneously, I have things that are telling my brain what's going on, and my brain talks to nerve endings that they need to start building bridges back together, and my brain sends a coagulation of red blood cells there that thicken and harden into a scab, but it also sends a coagulation of white blood cells there that we call pus to flush out the infection. In other words, friends, what I'm basically saying is this finely tuned watch of a universe, this finely tuned watch of our world, and this finely tuned watch of our human body demands a watchmaker. And there's much more even about God's creation. We can get into the animal world, which we don't have time to explain. Testimonies to the existence of God. The faith testimony, the scriptural testimony, the transcendental testimony, the cosmological testimony, the cause, the teleological testimony. There's a purpose in this intelligent design that is here. And the historical testimony. History testifies to the existence of God. In Daniel chapter 4, there was a man who was an unbeliever. He was an atheist concerning the God of the Bible. But in Daniel chapter 4, because of some things that happened in his own personal history, he readily acknowledges that there is a God who is in control and even controls all of history. God's deliverance of his people, the miracles at Passover night and the Red Sea, the visions of Isaiah, the Shekinah glory in the temple, and many other things that have actually happened in history, not just biblical history, testify to the existence of God. The Christological testimony, the fact that Jesus of Nazareth lived, testifies that there is a God. Would you turn with me to John 21? John writes his book to people, really to the entire world, so that they would believe in Jesus Christ. In John chapter 21, verses 24 and 25, John says concerning himself, "This is the disciple who testifies of these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. And there are also many other things that Jesus did, which if they were written one by one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written therein." Hebrews chapter 1 says that God, who at sundry times and in various manner and means communicated himself in times past, in the Old Testament, in the prophets, but he has spoken to everyone today by his Son, Jesus Christ, who is the heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. Jesus Christ actually lived. Friends, what do you do with the man Jesus Christ? Secular historians cannot deny the fact that there was an actual man who actually lived on this earth named Jesus of Nazareth. And by the things that he did and the things that he said, his person, his works and his words, his virgin birth, his life, his mighty miracles, his good deeds, his death, his resurrection from the dead, his life accounts for the Bible. It accounts for fulfilled prophecies, his supernatural character, the influence of Christianity on the world and the fact of conversions, the change of people morally, mentally, and spiritually. By the things that he said and the things that he did, which no one can deny, he was one of three things. He was a raving madman. I mean, completely lost in his mind, out of his mind. Perhaps he should have been locked in a crazy house. the things he said and the things he did, saying, basically, he is God. And taking on the religious establishment at the time. That's crazy. Maybe he is a madman. Or he is a master at deceit, a master at trickery. I mean, you think the magicians that play in Las Vegas and have big shows from time to time on television that make cars disappear and buildings disappear and saw women in half are big time, masters of deceit, master at trickery. Some people really believe that Jesus Christ himself is that way. He's either a lunatic or he's a liar. He's the master of deceit. The things that he did in healing people, boy, there's got to be something up with that. He's either a lunatic or he's a liar. Or thirdly, you know, really, there's no other option. He's either a lunatic or he's a liar or he really is the Lord. What have you done with the testimony of Jesus Christ? At this point, I would highly recommend to you the first thing I would read if you would want to dive more into this topic. It is a few chapters taken from Josh McDowell's Evidence That Demands a Verdict. I could recommend all kinds of other things there to you at this point. I may as well do it right now. Resources that you can buy on the internet. If you have questions concerning creation, you can look up Answers in Genesis. I believe it's answersingenesis.org. Excellent resource place in which you can get there. And they publish a 2-volume set called The Answers Book. Questions people have concerning the existence of God, creation, evolution, the reliability of the Bible, The Answers Books, volumes 1 and 2. I think that would be a great start for you. And of course, they have other things listed there on their website, but Answers in Genesis, its headquarters is in Florence, Kentucky, and Ken Ham leads that. There's also the Institute for Creation Research, ICR, that's out in California. It was headed up by Henry Morris. He has since gone to be with the Lord, and his sons and grandsons head that up, the Morrises. They have some fantastic things on their site. If you are interested dealing with creationism, and does God really exist? Well, it seems like there's evolution out there, and everyone's talking evolution. Doesn't that disprove the existence of God? It goes against God's Bible. I would suggest 2 books. One is put out by ICR, Institute of Creation Research, by Henry Morris, The Twilight of Evolution. It's a small book. It's just an introductory for you, and it'll get you going on other things. The Twilight of Evolution, then also The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris. Would also recommend to you Darwin's Black Box by Michael Behe. Darwin's Black Box. If you're interested in the evolution debate, creationism, The Twilight, and both of those books are relatively small, easy to understand. The Twilight of Evolution and Darwin's Black Box. And those are a couple of places. If you are interested in apologetics, just the existence of God and the reliability of the Bible apart from creation, the 2 places I've just mentioned deal mostly with God's existence and creation, evolution topic. But if you're interested in God's existence and the reliability of the Bible, I would send you perhaps to Ravi Zacharias. You can look up his website. But a resource for you would be by Josh McDowell. I think it's joshmcdowellministries.org. Josh McDowell has Evidence That Demands a Verdict, a very thick book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict, and it comes in volumes 1 and 2. I think the second one is More Evidence That Demands a Verdict. But back to the Christological testimony, Josh McDowell has taken a chapter or two from his Evidence That Demands a Verdict and compiled it into a little booklet, which I highly recommend to you at this point to read, and that is called More Than a Carpenter. More Than a Carpenter by Josh McDowell. I believe you can get on Amazon or ChristianBook.com and get a copy for probably $2 or $3. It's short. The cookies are on the lower shelf. You can readily understand it, but it will greatly help you concerning the Christological testimony. Now, back to the testimonies of God's existence. Again, are you with me? Do we need to review? Okay, we've talked about the introduction that we're calling these testimonies and the nature of the evidence. You can't prove the factuality of everything the exact same way. The presuppositional conflict of worldviews, we all approach this topic with presuppositions and a pre-commitment. The nature of general revelation, there's the faith testimony, the scriptural testimony, the transcendental testimony, the cosmological testimony, there's the cause of all of creation, the teleological testimony, there's a purpose in this intelligent design that is out here, the historical testimony, not hysterical, historical testimony, God, we see him in history, Christological testimony, the existence of Jesus Christ. Now let's talk about the moral testimony, sometimes called the anthropological testimony. And it's stated like this: every man has a sense of obligation of what is right and wrong, together with an undeniable feeling of responsibility to do what is right and a sense of self-condemnation whenever he commits what is wrong. There is in him, as it were, a voice that will not be silenced, ever saying to his inner consciousness, "You should do such and such, and you should not do such and such." This presupposes that there is a speaker, and moreover, one that is Lord and sovereign over a human being. In other words, dear friends, how is it that morals are found all worldwide, that there are consciences that are worldwide, even though we vary so differently in our cultures? Everyone has a conscience, and everyone has a voice inside of them that says you should or you shouldn't do this. Where does the voice come from? And number two, where do those morals, those same morals, as we talked about earlier, it's wrong to take another man's wife in every culture. And in every culture, it's wrong to murder a friend. Where does that come from? We list in the notes there numerous passages of Scripture. Psalm 32, verses 3 and 4. We'll turn to Psalm 32, verses 3 and 4. And it says there, "When I kept silent from confessing my sins to you, my bones grew old through my groaning all day long, for day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer." In Psalm 38, verses 1 through 4, it says, "O Lord, do not rebuke me in your wrath, nor chasten me in your hot displeasure, for your arrows pierce me deeply, and your hand presses me sore." Micah chapter 6, verse 8, "He has told thee, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of thee? But to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God." In other words, we already know, deep on the inside, what we must be doing. In Acts chapter 17, verses 28 and 29, Paul says to the people in Mars Hill in Athens, Greece, who were listening to him as he was speaking, Paul said, "For in God we live and move and have our being, as also some of your own prophets have said, for we are also his offspring. Therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like God or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devising." And in Romans chapter 2, which we have already referred to, speaking of the conscience that a person has, the fact, friends, of moral obligation and duty is at least as certain as the fact of existence. I exist, I sense moral obligation. You exist, you sense moral obligation, for whatever. And on the basis of conscience, there is freedom, immortality in God. Now, Immanuel Kant called this the categorical imperative. I'm not going to take the time right now to get off into Immanuel Kant and his categorical imperative, but I'm just throwing that out there if you want to be looking that up. Concepts of right and wrong can be found in the system of belief of all groups. Where do those ideas of right and wrong originate? Morality, intelligence, emotions, and religious consciousness. All aspects of the soul cannot be products of evolution. Lifeless offspring bringing about morality, emotions, and religious consciousness? How can that come about by evolution? So that is the moral testimony. The ontological testimony. And really, in my own mind, this is not a very good one at all. We have an idea of God, but I'm giving out what you say, well, if it's not very good, why are you giving it out to us? Well, it is a testimony that is out there in history. We have an idea of God. This idea of God is infinitely greater than man himself. Hence, since the idea of God, which is greater than man himself, could not have originated in man, it must have its source in God himself. It deals a little bit with the moral testimony and the conscience that is there. In Romans chapter 1, Romans chapter 1, verse 20, Paul addresses this. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and his Godhead, so that human beings are without excuse. The very idea of God testifies to his existence. And lastly, the last testimony I'm going to give to you concerning the existence of God is the congruity testimony. You say, what's the congruity testimony? I've never heard of that before. In other words, all of these testimonies put together in a congruous passage and package, and the postulate that best explains the related facts is true. In other words, dear friends, all of these testimonies wrapped together are pointing somewhere. God is incomprehensible. The Bible makes this clear in Job 11, Isaiah 40, and Romans 11. We can't fully understand him, yet we can know him. John, in John 17, verse 3, where he's quoting Jesus, Jesus said, "This is life eternal, to know thee." And 1 John 5:20 says it was written that we can know Jesus Christ and we can know God. The belief in the existence of God best explains the facts of our moral, mental, and religious nature, as well as the facts of the material universe. Therefore, God exists. God exists. Yes, you could look at all of these statements that I've just given, the testimonies, and say, okay, some of them have some circular reasoning, some of them have some bigger holes in them than others, but dear friends, answer them. They're pointing somewhere. What do you do with all of them? What do you do with them? The Bible says in Psalm 14, verse 1, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Now, please don't misunderstand me. God isn't debasing himself to name-calling here. When he calls someone a fool, he is describing their nature and how they're thinking and how they're acting. It is very foolish for you to be thinking that there is not a God. As a matter of fact, I really believe that Paul gets into the same thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 17 to 29, when he talks about the wisdom of this world. The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those who are being saved is the power of God, for it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Then Paul kind of rhetorically calls out, like in Proverbs, where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For Jews requested a sign and Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness. Yes. To the Greeks, they were wanting wisdom. Give it to me in wisdom. But it defies the wisdom of our age. And dear friend, if you are going to use some of this argumentation with an atheist, an agnostic, or someone who is out there, or perhaps you're listening to it now, wondering about the existence of God, don't be foolish. The Bible says in Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 23, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like unto corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness and to the lusts of their own heart. In other words, God is speaking to you. If you claim to be an atheist, an agnostic, someone who's wondering about the existence of God, God is speaking to you. In all of these testimonies I've given, God is speaking. He's reaching out. He's showing Himself. Are you going to acknowledge Him as God or not? What do you do with all of these testimonies given? What do you do with them? If you would like to call at Grace Baptist Church or write or email, I'd be delighted to speak or set up some time to talk with you further about these things.